ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife foreign correspondent.
This situation in Ukraine now, a huge dam in the Russian-controlled area in the south of the country has been destroyed. It's unleashed a massive flood. Thousands of people have been evacuated from their homes and hundreds of thousands have no access to clean drinking water. Ukraine officials have warned that it could take years for affected farmland to recover. The UN's humanitarian chief, Martin Griffiths, has had this to say.
It's one of the most significant incidents of damage to civilian infrastructure since the start of the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. The sheer magnitude of the catastrophe will only become fully realized in the coming days, but it's already clear that it will have grave and far-reaching consequences for thousands of people.
It's not clear what caused the damage to the Novohahovka Dam, but Ukraine's military has accused Russia of blowing it up. The Kremlin's denied the claim, and they say the Ukrainians blew it up, so here we go. Turkey has called for a thorough and independent investigation of how the dam was breached, and it comes as mixed reports are emerging as to whether or not the long-expected Ukraine counteroffensive into Russia-held territory has actually begun or not. Well, to try and enlighten us on some of these things, joining me now from the UK is Frank Gardner, BBC's security correspondent. Frank's a very experienced and seasoned observer of military stories, journalist, author, and also a retired British Army Reserve officer. He's been in the Middle East and the Gulf, and he's also covered the war on terror. Frank, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Thank you.
Terrific to have you with us too. Just describe the devastation of this dam breach.
It's absolutely massive. This was holding back a vast area, 100 miles plus of a reservoir. I mean, it was... This thing is the size of the Great Salt Lake in Utah. It was not only providing drinking water for millions of people, it was obviously providing hydroelectric power, but also enormous amounts of water that was used for irrigation of Ukraine's very fertile southern plains. So breaching this dam, and you're right, it's still unexplained exactly how this happened. Breaching this dam, the effect of this has been catastrophic in humanitarian terms because it's displaced tens of thousands of people. It's meant that the banks of the Dnieper River, which downstream, which had been mined by the Russians, are now awash with these floating mines, which explode on contact with debris or with people. So it's a massive hazard that. It's also going to affect the course of the war, I think, because this now makes it much harder for Ukraine, as a part of its offensive, to try and use that area to attack Russian positions from. You can't mount a military operation in a flooded plain where you've got tens of thousands of displaced people.
No, exactly. So who do we think blew it up? The Russians, do we?
Well, most NATO sources are pretty convinced it was the Russians. The Russians deny it. I mean, you've got to look at who was in control of this dam. The Russians were.
Right.
They controlled it. So if it was the Ukrainians, they would have had to have sneaked in at night doing a kind of special forces sabotage job. It's not inconceivable. They have done similar operations, but it's not in their interest to do this. I mean, if it turned out that Ukraine had done it, effectively causing ruin for thousands of their own people, this would be a political scandal that would sink the Zelensky government, I would think. So it's very unlikely Ukraine did it. The question is, if it was Russia, was it deliberate? Was it cock-up or conspiracy? And just before anybody gives me grief about the word cock-up, this comes from the cock feather of an arrow. If you fire an arrow with the cock feather upwards, it's not going to go straight. It's not a rude word. Just putting it out there.
Thank you. thanks, Frank.
In case you get Mrs. Angry from Adelaide giving you grief on that one. it's possible that it was a cock-up, that the... let's assume it was explosives because it must have been something pretty powerful to have breached this dam. I mean, this is a Soviet-era dam built to withstand air and missile attack. So it wasn't breached easily. But if the Russians were the ones that placed those explosives, I'm not sure they intended to have this big a consequence because it has also flooded a lot of the areas that they were defending. one thing is very clear, that their troops downstream on the east bank of the River Dnipro, which is now flooded, heavily flooded, they didn't know this was coming. Now, it's perfectly possible that the Russian high command, only a few people thought of this, knew about it, and didn't tell those below them. There is a bit of history here, a bit of previous. In 1941, the Red Army, the Soviets, blew up a dam over the Dnipro, which killed thousands of Soviet citizens in order to stop a Nazi advance.
They did it for the same reason, didn't they? It makes an advance from the west towards the east into Russian-held territory more difficult, because you'd have to proceed over water-soaked plains, and therefore armored vehicles, tanks, and so on really can't traverse this area. So, in a sense, there's a powerful strategic defensive reason why Russia might have done this.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk about Ukraine's big counteroffensive, which may or may not be underway, but this will certainly be. It'll have the effect of throwing it slightly off course, because Ukraine's got a humanitarian tragedy on its hands. It's got to divert resources and attention to that. And as we said, it blocks off that western area. I think if you can try and visualize the battleground, the battlefield in Ukraine, divvy it up into three areas: west, central, and eastern. The eastern bit is the Donbass. That's where a lot of the fighting's been going on around Bakhmut. That's still going on. Ukraine is making small incremental advances there, but it's pretty tiny stuff. In the center, and I say the center, it's the center of the south, this is going to be Ukraine's main effort. For Ukraine to make any real impact on the Russian occupation, it needs to drive a wedge down, splitting the Russian occupied area into two, and drive down southwards towards the Sea of Azov and the coast. Now, the Russians have had a look at the map and they thought, where do we think Ukraine's going to attack? There. So let's build three successive layers of defense in depth, with big trenches that tanks can't cross, pyramid-shaped dragon's teeth obstacles that tanks can't get through, minefields, pre-located, zeroed-in artillery, bunkers, you name it. That is going to be a tough nut to crack. That still stands there in the center. And it's possible that Ukraine was planning to go around the side to the west. They're not going to be able to do that now because of the flooded plains.
Yes, there's some talk, isn't there, about the water levels in the dam being particularly high just before the dam was blown up. Russia, as you say, controlled the dam. Did they deliberately allow the water level to rise to make the devastation of breaching it even greater?
Do you know, a friend of mine who spent a lot of time in Russia and knows the Russian army fairly well said, look, if ever there's the question about is it cock-up or conspiracy when it comes to Russian military, the answer is nearly always it's cock-up. It's some kind of a mistake. I mean, the Ukrainians accuse sorry, there's a lot of noise going on in the back here. I thought I'd chosen a quiet place, but apparently not.
No, it's fine. So we can't hear a thing. Yeah, go on.
Good stuff. Who knew we had fun here at the BBC? The Ukrainians are accusing the Russians of having sort of drunk people in charge of the dam, and that these drunkards had stopped some people being allowed to exit safely and be evacuated safely. It's perfectly possible. I mean, drunkenness is an endemic problem in the Russian military. We've seen plenty of evidence of low morale. You've got to remember that whereas the Ukrainians are fighting to kick the invader out of their own country, all these Russians, not all of them, but a lot of them don't know why they're there. They are not as motivated as the Ukrainians. They've been mobilized, many of them. They don't necessarily particularly want to be there. They don't have the kind of core of NCO expertise that Western armies, that the Australians, the Kiwis, the Brits, the Americans have, where anyone who's served will tell you that the backbone of the army, it's not the officers, it's the non-commissioned officers, it's the corporals and sergeants, who in Western armies, in NATO and allied armies, are given the initiative. They're allowed to take that initiative. In the Russian army, that doesn't happen. You've got to refer upwards. And it's very few important decisions are taken below the rank of major.
Do you think, what's your view on whether this counter-offensive has begun or not?
Well, I think the way to look at it, Philip, is that it's a series of events, not a series of unfortunate events, but a series of events. And the different phases will overlap. So there's no question that the shaping phase, as it's called, began some time ago. It began with long-range missile strikes by Ukraine at Russia's rear areas, trying to hit its logistics, blow up its ammunition depots, its fuel depots, its command and control centers, making its communications and transport difficult, staging attacks just inside the border, at the Russian border at Belgorod, trying to throw the Russians off balance in the hopes of drawing their some of their defending forces away from the areas that Ukraine wants to attack. So that's all part of shaping the battlefield ready for the main effort. And I'm not a boxer, but I think I would probably, the analogy I would use, Philip, here is imagine two boxers in the ring, and you've got this great big lumbering heavyweight boxer. That's Russia with its big army, its big numbers, its big artillery. And you've got this middleweight Ukrainian guy dancing nimbly around, and he's doing a lot of pokes with his left. He's a right-handed guy, and he's doing a lot of pokes with his left fist, just jabbing away here and there, nothing too substantial, just probing, just prodding his opponent to see where his weak spots are, ready to deliver a big hammer punch with the right fist. That is the analogy I would give. That's basically how what is happening right now. The big effort hasn't started yet. There are reports, unsubstantiated, that some Ukrainian forces are starting to move south of Zaporizhia, which is the center of the south, and that's the area that Ukraine needs to really advance into. But we've not yet seen any evidence of big armored columns. Ukraine is keeping all these Leopard 2s, Challenger 2s, all these big formations of Western-supplied main battle tanks. They're keeping them in reserve. And I think when they find a weak spot, they will pour some of these armored brigades through the gap and try and exploit it to throw the Russians off balance. A lot of this is about psychology, and there's a lot of psyops going on in this. There's a lot of information warfare with the Russians saying, ha, the Ukrainians have been trying to beat us in Bakhmut, but we've beaten them back. We've inflicted colossal casualties on them. There's no evidence of that. So a lot of this is propaganda on both sides.
The stated aim of the Ukrainians is to take back the Crimean Peninsula. This, to many people, seems a distant, if not impossible, goal. After all, would Russia ever, would they ever give this up, given that it contains their big Sevastopol naval base, for a start, which they always leased from the Ukrainians when Crimea was part of Ukraine? Well, Crimea is still part of Ukraine if you're on the Ukrainian side of history here. To do that, to take back Crimea, they have to cut off the Russians from being able to supply Crimea. They have to get across the Dnipro at some point, don't they? How are they ever going to do that now?
You're asking exactly the right questions, Philip. In May last year...
Oh, we've lost you.
So just about
sorry,
a
just
year
start
ago,
again there. Just start again there, Frank. We just lost
your line. I interviewed President Zelensky over the phone. It was a Chatham House forum thing. And I asked him, what is the minimum you would... Oh, yeah. In May last year, just over a year ago, I interviewed President Zelensky. The minimum that you would accept in a peace deal with Russia? And he said, we would need to see them move back to where they were on February the 23rd, 2022. He didn't mention Crimea. He just said, we need their forces to withdraw from, you know, the main bulk of Ukrainian territory. But over the summer, Ukraine enjoyed quite a number of military successes. They've got Bulda, and he started talking about getting Crimea back as well. You're absolutely right that this is a red line for Russia. Not just the Kremlin, not just Putin and the Crimea is sovereign Russian territory.
Yes.
It was gifted in 1954 by Khrushchev to one of the Soviet socialist republics, Ukraine, and they simply said, look, we've just taken it back and it's ours. And I think, you know, even an opposition figure like Alexei Navalny is on record for saying that Crimea is Russian. So that is going to be very tricky indeed. But if Ukraine in their summer offensive is able to, they can make it very difficult for Russia to carry on supplying their garrison in Crimea. I mean, Crimea is one big fortified peninsula. If Ukraine decides to take it militarily, it's going to be a really bloody battle, and I'm not sure they'd be successful. Indeed. Heavily fortified.
Indeed. Frank Gardner's with us, BBC security correspondent. Just one thing before you go, Frank, and this is what's puzzled many as well. Australia is apparently on the brink of giving Ukraine our old FA-18 aircraft, which have been superseded by, of course, the new purchase of 75 of the latest iteration of the Joint Strike Force.
F-35s.
That's right, exactly. Mm. So up until this stage, it has not been, the Ukraine has not been an air war, even though, of course, air superiority these days in modern warfare is considered to be absolutely vital. Why do you think that is, and might it become an air war?
It's the reason that we've seen very little air activity is that both sides have got very effective air defenses, ever increasing, and also electronic warfare. It has been too dangerous for the Russians have got a really formidable air force, which wreaked untold destruction on Syria, in support of their ally, the Syrian president. So General Surovikin, who was briefly in charge of Russian operations in Ukraine, when he was in Syria, he was known as General Armageddon, and he basically ordered the flattening of large parts of Aleppo. Well, the Russians could do that because the rebels didn't have any effective air defense, but the Ukrainians do. They had some pretty good stuff at the beginning of this war. They've got some very good stuff now, like Patriots. But you're absolutely right. We've seen very little air activity. The Russians have lost about 100 aircraft so far, but they've got 1,000 kept back in reserve. President Zelensky and the Ukrainians have been asking for a long time. When he came here in February to Britain, he produced a helmet of a Ukrainian MiG-29 pilot saying, you know, we have, it was something like, we've got the people, give us the wings for freedom, some words to this effect. And he's been begging for aircraft. And it was not until the G7 meeting in the Far East in Tokyo recently, or was it Bali? I forget. Anyhow, in the very recent G7 meeting, where President Biden finally authorized the release of F-16s. This is the aircraft that the Ukrainians want. And one initial reaction from a Ukrainian commander was, well, we're not really sure about it. That's very nice of Australia to offer us the FA-18s, but we don't have the capacity to manage lots of different aircraft types. We just want one. But I think that the rest of the Ukrainian high command will take whatever they can get. I mean, the FA-18 Hornet, yes, it's been around since the 1980s, but it's a very effective bit of kit. And I think I'm right in saying that the 41 FA-18 Hornets that Australia is offering to give to Ukraine, which are sitting in storage and were due to be sort of either broken up, sold for scrap, or used as enemy in training, they're in pretty good nick because they've not been landing on aircraft carriers. So I've watched these things land on US aircraft carriers, and they land with a whacking great big thump. It really shakes the airframe. And so that limits the time, the life of those airframes. But the Aussie ones are in pretty good nick. So they can carry a serious payload. They've got a much greater range than the F-16s. The F-16's got a combat range of about 300 miles or so. These have got combat range of around 1,500 to 2,000 miles. And they've got a number of pods or hard points under their wings where they can carry a whole different load of ordnance. So it would make a huge difference.
Mm. Okay. Frank, Frank, we might leave it there. The audio is a little bit wobbly from our end, but it's been terrific to have your observations as well. And I do thank you for your time. I appreciate it very much. Thanks and good night.
No worries. Sorry about the audio.
Yeah, no, it's not your fault, Frank. But thank you anyway. Frank Gardner, BBC security correspondent, there on with his take on what's going on, the latest in the Ukraine war, with this breach of the dam on the Dnipro River causing major mayhem downstairs, and does it throw into doubt or chaos the plans for the Ukrainian counteroffensive? We don't know. But plenty of military strategists believe that it does reduce the options for Ukraine, and that's probably right.
Nightlife with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.